as well as the Bayit and Shai Shamayim for partnering on our series. This is the second class in our current three-part series. The first class last week, I sent out the link for the recording. Next week's topic is going to be the ethics of swag, talking about conflicts of interest and gifts received from clients and all of that. But this week's topic is non-disclosure agreements. And it was a topic that was actually sent to me, not sent to me, it was actually suggested during a class that we had in the last series, when we had our November series. So one of the sessions that we had was on the toxic workplace. And we dealt with COVID issues, we dealt with Hockey Canada issues. And so someone suggested that we talk about non-disclosure agreements. So here we are with non-disclosure agreements as the topic. I will note the message that I've been putting in the chat along with the link for the source sheet. Sign-ins are required if you want to get a letter confirming that you were here. To make sure that I'm clear in the way I say that, having your screen on is wonderful, but we're not recording video. And having your name on is wonderful as well, but we're not writing those down. After the session is over, I'm able to cut and paste the chat, and that's how I know that you were here. So please make sure that you write your name in the chat. If for some reason the chat is not accessible to you, you're on your phone or something like that, then send me an email during the class, please, to let me know that you're here. Okay. Also, please, you know, I would love to see your faces. It's a lot easier to give a class like this when I actually see people. I understand people are eating lunch, but again, we're not recording your faces. We're not recording video. So you're with 20-something of your closest friends. And it makes it a lot easier to give the shiur. Now, normally, when we have these classes, I spend time both on the civil law and the code for accountants and on Jewish law and Jewish ethics. But in this case, we have so much to talk about, we're not going to have time to look at both systems properly, the Jewish system and the secular system. When I do the legal ethics classes, those are an hour and a half. And for that, I think it's a lot more doable. But for these sessions, it's not so doable. We max out at an hour. So I may revisit this topic in a legal ethics session at some point in order to be able to incorporate more of civil law and the accounting code. Okay, but let's launch in. So non-disclosure agreements, or NDAs, as I'm just going to call them, definitely not a Shavuos night topic to the person who just messaged me. We need people to stay awake Shavuos night. So NDAs have a benign side and a malevolent side. On the benign side, the goal of an NDA is to protect a business from unwillingly sharing its research and its internal information with competitors. That's what it's about. And it fits very well with Jewish values. We talk about Lashon Hara, not spreading negative things about others. We talk about Rechilus, not gossiping about others. So, you know, that's relatively straightforward. We're going to talk about intellectual property in Judaism in a little bit. But if you take a look at the first source on the source sheet, this is an article I picked at random. I could have picked a dozen other articles. The article is called Equitable Remedy Provisions in NDAs, the Empty Clause, at Lexpert. In today's information economy, one of the most valuable assets a business can protect is its intellectual property. Executing a confidentiality agreement prior to disclosing information, whether in a standalone non-disclosure agreement or as a restrictive clause within a larger transactional agreement, is one of the best ways to protect such information, binding the parties to preserve confidentiality, right? This is relatively straightforward. I don't think there's anything particularly controversial in that. The definition of confidential information will vary from clause to clause. But in the absence of clear guidance, courts will consider whether the information is generally unknown to others, right? You can't confine somebody and say you can't disclose something that everybody knows. Known to others within the specific industry or others connected to the business, capable of being acquired elsewhere by those outside the business entity, and unique, original, or novel in some way, amongst other factors. These are all considerations in the event that your document isn't clear. Examples of confidential information include, but aren't limited to, financial data, pricing matrices, business strategies, even trade secrets, which are subject to their own protection. Confidential information may include something stamped as confidential or orally indicated to be confidential, even if it doesn't meet the above criteria. And it gives you an example of a confidentiality clause. Both parties agree to endeavor to take all reasonable measures to keep in confidence the execution, terms and conditions, as well as performance of this agreement, and the confidential data and information of any party that another party may know or access during performance of this agreement, and shall not disclose, make available, or assign such confidential information to any third party without the prior written consent of the party providing the information. And we're going to talk more about this and what Judaism empowers a company to restrict, but on a very basic level, this is relatively benign. And then there's also the malevolent side of NDAs. When we start talking about a non-disclosure agreement which is forced upon a victim of a crime, or it's used to protect perpetrators of a crime, it can be used to enable, frankly, future crime. And they can harm consumers by hiding the problems of a business. They can harm future employers. They can harm people who are themselves victims already. If you take a look at source number 2, I brought an example of an issue here regarding real estate transactions. This is from the Globe and Mail. The writer is Shane Dingman. I'm just going to put the link in the chat once again for the source sheet. A couple of more people joined. But take a look at source number 2. Ontario moves to ban use of non-disclosure agreements in real estate transactions. Confidentiality clauses or non-disclosure agreements are increasingly found in all manner of legal agreements Canadians enter into. But as of April 1st, 2023, Ontario real estate professionals will be restricted from using them when settling a dispute with a client. To advocates pushing for an end to the widespread use of NDAs, the changes are welcome. But for an industry where reputation is a valuable currency, it could raise the stakes for realtors facing complaints or business disputes. One of the main reasons any party wants to settle is they don't want their dirty laundry in public. She goes on to say, as a home buyer, I wouldn't want to hire a realtor with 6 settlements, but if I were the lawyer acting for him, I would still want to have the ability to use a confidentiality clause. So the realtor doesn't want everybody to know their business and that they've had 6 settlements. On the other hand, future client of realtor absolutely wants to know. So you have the positive side, and you also have the dangerous side of NDAs. Let me pause here. Questions and comments. You know, not looking to litigate the shear yet. That's going to come next. But on an introductory level, anything in particular that anyone would like to point out? No.
Yes,
Jerry.
I'd like to point out that there's a third type of non-disclosure agreement.
Yeah.
We can call it the Donald Trump type agreement, which also is against ethics, I believe. Where you're buying a person's silence.
Right, that's one of those that we included. That was the second one. That was the malevolent one. I began that by saying that these are NDAs that can be forced upon a victim of a crime and used to protect perpetrators as well as enable future crime. Like that's very much in camp number 2. You are quite correct. It is in the headlines. I was not planning on naming him, but lo and behold, he made it. Okay, so let's launch into the discussion itself. And again, I'll remind those who just joined that they should please make sure to sign in the chat if they want a letter certifying that they were here. So case number 1 speaks to the benign NDA. and a question of the right of a company to the intellectual property generated by an employee. So looking at the first vignette, the first case, which you can see on your sheet there, Honein Da'at is a company developing large language modules for commercial applications. For those who aren't familiar with the term large language module, we're talking ChatGPT. We're talking about something which has absorbed a tremendous amount of information and is able to use that information in order to, well, among other things, engage in very human conversations with people, engage in various kinds of creative activities. They have commercial applications for it. Some of you were here a few years ago, I think it was 4 years ago, 3 years ago, when we talked about robo-advisors. So part of what a robo-advisor does could very well be large language module. So, Honein Da'at is developing them for commercial applications. The company recruits Susan, a talented graduate student in computer science. They present her with an NDA, stipulating that all confidential information they provide, as well as all intellectual property, marketing and development information, computer code, and quote, any and all sensitive information, end quote, related to her work, other than that which is known generally in the industry, will remain in the exclusive property of the employer throughout the term of her employment and for an additional 3 years. Susan has never been employed before, right? She's just out of grad school. She is confused as to her rights to her work. Would Jewish law or ethics support Honein Da'at's claim to her work? So my question is now not a secular question. We're not asking the question of under Ontario law or federal law, Employment Act. I'm asking the question within Judaism. Do you think the company is able to say to Susan, we don't want you to share the information that you're generating, your research results? Are they able to restrict that in Judaism? What would you say? Provide a basis. Intellectual properties. That's really what we're talking about. Yes. You'll see. I mean, otherwise we wouldn't have a shear on it. I would just skip that one. But no, we have things to talk about. Intellectual property legislation is new, relatively new, historically. But you'll see where the roots are. So first of all, on a very basic level, Judaism recognizes intellectual property rights if the...
What's about
Geneva Das? So Geneva Das is a funny term to use. You're right from a literal standpoint. Oh, you could put your screen back on. Geneva Das from a literal term, literal translation means theft of information or theft of knowledge. But it isn't used that way. It's used to refer to deception. When you cheat somebody else in terms of making them think one thing and something else is happening. So that's a different story. But it's a good thought. Judaism recognizes intellectual property rights if the intellectual property is generated with your physical object. Let's start from that standpoint. You know, in secular law, the roots of intellectual property are relatively late, as I said, and they come from a few different places. William Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England, he says an author owns the rights to the fruits of his labor. An author has the rights to the fruits of his labor. You produced it, therefore it's used. And that's, sort of a vague statement. It doesn't offer legal theory. It's simply a statement. But the theories include government grants this right in order to encourage the advancement of learning. We want to protect creators so that there will be creativity. Another approach is that copyright is trade regulation. Just like there's communications law or fair competition enforcement, government wants to make sure that there will be peace in the competitive sphere. Another approach is to say that copyright and the right to one's information is not really an economic thing, but rather whatever you create is an extension and continuing expression of yourself, like part of your, like, part of your body. Just like your arm is part of you, so whatever you generate with your mind is part of you. All of these are theories that are suggested to explain copyright law, intellectual property law more broadly in the secular sphere. In Jewish law, we start out by saying, and this goes back to my point about the physical object, that in the event that you generate information via a physical object, which in today's situation may be a computer, lab equipment, the company is able to reserve the right to all discoveries made with their equipment. It was information that came from your physical object. You are entitled to say, I don't want you to use my object in that way. Whatever was generated with it has to be mine. And here I take you back in Jewish law, if you take a look at source number 3 on your sheet, to the 11th century in Morocco. Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, also known as the Rif, dealt with a very interesting circumstance. As always, I'm going to read out my English translation, but you can see the original Hebrew there as well. Question, someone puts to Rabbi Alfasi. One of the students stole another person's books of commentaries. When he demanded it back, the student says, I want that back. The thief swore a severe oath that he would not return them before copying them. He swears, I'm not giving it back until I copy it. And somebody he went to ruled that he could do that. He was entitled to take them in order to be able to copy them. So here's your situation, right? You're in yeshiva, and and somebody else takes your book and says, I want to copy the information that's in the book. I'm going to give the book back. Is he allowed to do so? Rabbi Alfasi's answer, seen here in source number 3, he says, the thief and the one who ruled are both mistaken and acted improperly. The one who ruled that this is permitted thinks that since he's learning Torah, this is a mitzvah. But he's wrong. The Talmud says a stolen or dried out lulav is disqualified. Leave out the dried out, focus on the stolen. You can't fulfill a mitzvah with a transgression. You can't steal a lulav and use it for your mitzvah. And the same argument Rabbi Alfasi says applies here. In the event that you are using somebody else's notes in a way that they do not approve, you're guilty of a form of theft. And he goes on. I didn't bring his entire responsum. But the application here is, if a company says, you are generating information with our lab equipment on our computers, we reserve the right for all such information to be ours, they're able to do so. If it's not generated with a physical plant, then there's a lot more to discuss. But the problem you run into is if we were to turn this class into a discussion of intellectual property law, we would never get to the meat of NDAs. So I gave you in source number 4 a link to a class I gave years ago, a brief history of the origins of Jewish intellectual property law, and you're welcome to listen to that. But the basics of it is that for our purposes, a company is able to restrict the use of information generated with their physical plant. That's number 1. Number 2, Judaism will recognize secular law if secular law indicates that intellectual property is protected. That's also basic principle. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 5, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, and we mentioned this, I think, last week as well, says, government law is recognized in matters that benefit the king. He's dealing in Poland in the 16th century. He talks about kings. Matters that benefit the king or that benefit the citizenry. But not that we're now going to judge all our cases by the laws of idolaters. We're not getting rid of our Torah, but we will recognize laws that are intended to benefit the king and laws that are intended to benefit the citizens of the land. And intellectual property law, for the reasons that we mentioned before, whether it's trade regulation, whether it's to encourage creativity, all the different explanations you want to give, are fundamentally, those laws are meant to benefit society. And therefore, they will indeed be binding. There's a practical application of that in source number 6. Rabbi Yitzchak Shmalkis was a rabbi in 19th century Galicia. He dealt with a whole host of very, very interesting issues. And he dealt with this issue of the law of the land being the law. In the interest of time, because it's already 1252, I'm not going to read it aloud. But his point was to say that not only is the law of the land binding because it's the law of the land, but also because it becomes the industry standard. And therefore, when you become employed, or when you engage in a transaction, you agree that your interactions are going to be governed by whatever is minag hamedina, the practice of the land. So for that reason as well, if the government says that a company has the right to the intellectual property generated in its employ, then that becomes law of the land / standard practice. There's also a third issue, and that is the issue of unfair business practices. If Susan discloses information about the company and that is used by her next employer, because the next employer does not have the right to force Susan's current employer, Chonin Dat, to share their IP with them. You follow? The next employer is going to use that information. That's harming the first one. Let me just ask. I'm going a little bit quickly with this because I wanted to get to some of the meteor NDA issues. But is this clear? What we're saying? Yeah, Miriam.
Are you referring to the what she develops herself or other things that she learns about the company?
So I'm referring to both kinds of protection, but in this case, it's specifically that which she develops, which is owned by the company, the intellectual property that the company claims ownership of.
And again, it's because she's using the tools of the company.
Correct.
So if she was at home during COVID using her own laptop and working for the company, would that change anything?
So it depends, right? You lose the physical plant argument potentially unless she's using information on their server or, you know, it depends how many steps back you want to go in this, including what information they gave her that she is now using, on which she is you know, bootstrapping in order to build what she does now. It's training also. It's, you know, collaboration with other people. So there's a whole range of ways in which they're interacting. But the issue of unfair business practices is a particularly fascinating one. Some of you may have been there. I gave a class, I don't know, it's got to be 8 or 9 years ago, on Kalua versus Kafua. Anybody remember the story, if not my class on it? The class wasn't at Zeitman's, it was somewhere else, an accounting firm that shall not be named. But the people know, I expect, what Kalua is, right? So that is a liquor that in many places is not kosher. Leave aside questions of the kashrus of Kalua, not our discussion. Somebody in Brooklyn generated a knockoff, and the label on it looked very much like the Kahlua label. Same colors, same structure, same themes. And they called it Kafua. K-A-H-F-U-A instead of L-U-A. And so they got sued by Kahlua for doing so. So in part of that discussion, it dealt with this issue. Sorry, Ontario Emergency Alert System. I imagine all of you have the same thing. Okay, so the issue becomes that the company is entitled to deal with, to decide who benefits from their labor. Companies are entitled to decide who is going to benefit from what they generate. We have this idea already when you're dealing with physical property. Real estate. If you take a look at source number 7, I brought you the comment from Tosfot, an anthology of commentaries on the Talmud, saying that you're allowed to keep other people from dwelling in your home. You're allowed to keep other people from living in your house, even though we normally have a rule that you're expected to share with others, so long as it doesn't hurt you. When it comes to living in your house, you are entitled to say, no, you don't get to live in my house. For two reasons, at least two reasons. One reason that's offered is in source number 8, and that is because theoretically you could make a profit by renting out your house, and now you lose that opportunity in the event that somebody is living there. That's source number 8. That's Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles. Or because, as seen in source number 9, it has nothing to do with business at all. This is my property. If you take a look at source number 9, Rabbi Yosef Chaviva, the Nimuke Yosef, quotes Rabbi Aaron Alevi, saying in 13th century Spain, even though we generally say that where one party benefits and the other party does not lose, we compel not to act as Sodom. Sodom is a model of a place where people don't want to help others, even if it doesn't cost them anything. So we tell you, normally you have to be helpful to others. But that's where both of the parties own land. And one is not using his at all, but can legally prevent the other one from using his own. For example, this is where one wishes to build opposite another person's window. The other person prevents him from blocking his light, even though the builder wishes to provide windows in another way, such that there would be no loss of light whatsoever. I'm going to explain that case a little bit more slowly and thoroughly. Where we say you're not allowed to act like Sodom, that's talking about the following circumstance. You own property. Somebody else owns the property next to you. They want to build their house taller. You say, that's going to block my light. They alter what they're doing in order to make sure you don't lose any light. And you still say, too bad, I'm going to exercise my legal power such that you can't do it. So that's acting like Sodom. You're not being harmed by what they're doing. So therefore, you're not allowed to stop them from doing what they want to do. As he says, in such a case, we compel. However, we don't say that you're obligated to let other people use your property. If that were true, then people would just run roughshod over everybody else's property. He says there's no such thing. Of course, Judaism recognizes that you own your property. Same thing, the company is entitled to say, we don't want other people using our labor. That's an argument. You follow? We clear? Another argument along the same lines is the argument from a passage in the Talmud in Bava Basra called Makiv V'Nikaf. Here's the situation. Two parties own land. One of them owns a field. The other one owns all the fields that are around the first field. Okay, so one of them holds the internal property, and the other one holds the external properties. So the internal field is surrounded on four sides. Okay? The owner of the external property starts to fence in the internal one to keep the property separate. Nothing should pass back and forth. So he puts in a fence on one side, puts in a fence on the second side, puts in a fence on the third side. Does the guy in the internal property have to pay anything for those barriers? What would you say? The external one wants to keep the property separate. Does the internal one have to pay anything for, because he's benefiting? Does he have to pay? Ostensibly, the answer is no. Because you made a decision to fence in the property. It's not my problem. You can fence it in on all four sides if you want. Leave me access. Obviously, I need to get out of my field and get into the field. But that's your business. That was a decision you made. However, what happens if the person who owns the outer fields puts in the first three fences, and then the owner of the internal one fences in the fourth side? Are they now responsible to pay for the first three, or some percentage of the first three? Can you make an argument? Moshe, what would you say?
Well, if he's fencing in the fourth side, then it should be up to the person that's fencing it in.
So the thing is, once the person on the inside demonstrates that he's happy about the fencing of the first three sides. Now he's a partner. At that point, he is a partner of the person who fenced in the other three because he's happy about that expenditure. And so the argument is made in source number 10, and it's brought in the Shulchan Aruch in the Code of Jewish Law, that once you demonstrate that you're happy about the fences, now you have to chip in your percentage of the deal. This was invoked in an intellectual property case by Rabbi Malkiel Tzvi Tannenbaum in 19th century Poland. The case involved a vendor who had bought the rights from the government to sell sweet, fragrant water. The government licensed out the right to engage in that industry. Somebody else copied the label from his water with the printed license that is on it, with the name of the licensed vendor on it, and then sold water. So the question is, what's the responsibility here? So Rabbi Tannenbaum in source number 11 said, this second person demonstrated that he was happy with the expenditure that the first one did in buying the license and in designing the license. You showed you're happy about it, then you have to pay for it. That was the argument. If you're going to do this, you have to pay for it. That's source number 11. So the argument here can be, if Susan's new employer gets this information, they're clearly happy about the investment that Honing Dot made to generate that. They should have to pay in for it. You follow? They are very happy about the investment that the company made. The company did not open this for everybody to use. The company said, we like this for ourselves. This is our property. Their competitor now wants to use that information. The company is within its rights to say, well, then you should be paying for our investment, separate from any theft issue. Last point in this section is that they're going to dilute the value of Honing Dot's intellectual property if they use it as well. This is called unfair competition. Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau in source number 12 points this out. He says, it seems that every discovery or invention in a craft or a form of work like a patent is subject to the rule against invading a boundary. They're invading your boundary. It's unfair competition. Or, as Rabbi Tannenbaum writes in number 13, we would view this potentially as direct harm to the business. So the bottom line out of all of this, and what we've said for the last half hour, is really that the employer has the right to restrict access to the intellectual property that is generated. Whether because it was generated with their physical plant, whether because it's the law of the land, whether because it's an unfair business practice, it's legitimate for them to do that. But now let's get into some of the more dicey areas of an NDA. And again, I'm going to reiterate what I said in the beginning. If people have finished their lunch and are available to have their screen on, that would be wonderful. Thank you. So the second case is coercing an NDA with a financial inducement. If you go back to the first side, case number 2, Susan tells Honing Dot that she is willing to sign an NDA that lasts for 1 year after her employment. They wanted 3 years, right? She says 1 year. And that allows her to use her computer code in areas that will not compete with Honing Dot. Thank you to those who just turned on their screens. I appreciate it. So she says, I'm not going to compete with you, number one. And I'm also willing to give you a year after employment. But the company is insistent and they offer her a large bonus to induce her to sign. They also hint that refusal to sign a 3-year NDA could lead them to rescind her job offer. Would Jewish ethics permit an employer to use financial inducements to pressure an employee to sign an NDA? From a secular perspective, I think the answer is sure, go ahead. Sorry, Miriam.
Pressure, a bit of a negative word. You could use the word induce and say the same thing.
I use both.
You know, but are you implying that it's negative to give money, somebody compensation for something? Isn't that just a simple transaction there?
Right. So at first glance, I entirely agree with you, Miriam. What's wrong? Susan is free to decline. Susan is free to go get a job somewhere else. Right? In general society, there's nothing wrong with making a strong push. Right? Not if you reach the level of harassment, but this is not harassment. What's the big deal? However, in Jewish ethics, the issue of pushing somebody to sell their property or their rights by making a strong offer actually is problematic. It's a spiritual issue, not a business issue. You may recall the 10th out of the 10 commandments, Lo Sachmod. Lo Sachmod means what? Do not covet. What does covet mean? We went from Hebrew to some other language. What does covet mean?
Want what somebody else has.
To want what somebody else has. So the problem is that the Torah actually uses multiple terms. It says lo tachmod. It also says lo sisaveh, which also means do not desire, like from the word ta'ava, desire what somebody else has. And what we understand is, first of all, the prohibition is not violated, according to the vast majority of authorities, just because you want what somebody else has. It may be unhealthy and a bad idea, but that's not a violation of the law. The violation of the law is once you start trying to obtain what somebody else has, and we learn specifically that that prohibition includes making a bully offer to get what they have. If you take a look at source number 14, from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, one who desires another person's servant, maid, home, or implement, or anything he can purchase from him, and who weighs him down with third parties, he tries to get people to push him for it, and he badgers him until he can buy it, violates you shall not desire. There is an issue of harassment that is in fact prohibited. You're not allowed to nudge somebody to the point where he finally says, fine, I'll do it. Now, making an offer once, saying to her, look, take it or leave it, this is our offer, I don't think you've crossed the line in doing so. But if there's a push and there's an, I'm going to give you more and I'm going to, to really force their hand, then I think you run into issues with being so aggressive. We talked about this in a session a while back when we talked about ethical advertising. So I brought you source number 15 in that session, talking about somebody who pushes another person to buy from him. And he says that that actually could potentially be a violation against what's called Hamas, which is its own thing. Okay. I'm just pointing it out because I thought that it was an interesting quirk. But let's talk more about duress or undue influence. Go back to the cases and specifically look at case number 3. Susan decides not to work at Chonin Da'at, and instead she's hired by their competitor, Machine Think. Late one night, Anthony, the veteran manager of Susan's division, texts her with an explicit request for sexual activity. Unsure what to do, Susan replies by email, requesting that Anthony not send her any such communications in the future. He apologizes and explains that he sent the text to her by accident, thought it was somebody else. But 3 months later, during a long holiday weekend, Anthony sends her further explicit texts, including photos of himself and overt requests which address her by name. On Monday morning, Susan shows the communications to the Machine Think HR department. By the end of the day, a Machine Think vice president comes to her desk with an offer of a $50,000 bonus for her hard work and an NDA prohibiting disclosure of Anthony's actions. The vice president is sympathetic, even hinting that this is not the first problem with Anthony and that she has been looking for an opportunity to investigate him. However, she explains that signing the NDA is required in order for Machine Think to begin investigating. Susan does not want to sign. Would an NDA signed under this form of pressure be valid within Jewish law? She has to sign in order to be able to get the investigation of this guy. Comes with a bonus, $50,000. Yes or no? Would Judaism be okay with this or not?
Hopefully not.
Hopefully not. Okay. Can you give me something to work with from Judaism?
The fact that what he's done is of a sexually exploitative nature, just to me, just turns my stomach and thinks that Judaism should not be on side with anything that wouldn't say right away, you have to go ahead with the investigation. But I don't have anything to stand on halakhically, too.
Right. Yes. Right.
A witness receives money. How can his testimony be valid?
Right. So that's an interesting question. It is correct. You can't pay for a witness. That may come up actually in next week's session when we talk about the ethics of swag and auditor issues. But it's true. You're not allowed to pay a witness. I suppose the argument could be, though, that she's not being paid by a side in the case. If the company is truly neutral and looking just to make sure that they're not having anything going on inappropriate at their company, their argument will be, we're not paying her for, you know, to influence her testimony. Which they're not. They're paying her to sign the NDA. That's really what this is. Terry. Well, which way would it discredit her? In other words, if she's going to come out and testify to the truth of what happened about Anthony,
yes,
will she lose any credibility because the company gave her this bonus?
The fact that she accepted it, I think would make her less credible than had she not. Or less
interesting.
Incredible.
I would have thought the other way. In the event that she testifies that nothing happened, then people will assume they bought her silence.
For sure.
You know, that I would have seen. So, as a general principle in Judaism...
Bye-bye.
Sorry? Yes, Moshe.
Do the rules of... does keeping silent fall under the jurisdiction of the Parshat Keretz?
Good. I'm going to come to that, but it's going to be a number four. Moshe asks, if someone is silent and doesn't say anything, is that called lying when there was in fact something that happened? So we have to get there. Generally speaking, a rabbinical court will overturn an agreement that was made under duress or undue influence. And I've decided I did not want to spend time on the question of duress versus undue influence and their definitions, because the legal definitions don't really matter for the purpose of our discussion. But an agreement that is entered into because of either pressure where there's a negative possibility in the event that you don't sign, or where there is a payment for it, a bully payment that comes in, that can be disqualified if one of two conditions is satisfied. Either if it was an obviously unwilling transaction, or if it was not obviously unwilling, but you informed witnesses in advance that you were engaging in it unwillingly. Those are your two options. So if you take a look on your sheet, we are now looking at, flipping back from the vignettes, source number 16 from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Code of Jewish Law. And again, reading just my translation. One who gives a gift due to compulsion, having been compelled to give it, it is not a gift. You give someone a gift because somebody told you, you're giving me a gift. That's not a gift at all. Even if he accepted replacement responsibility in a document, meaning even if the giver said to the recipient, I am giving this to you and I am responsible to replace it if something happens, and even if he does not give a moda'ah, moda'ah is something we're going to come back to in a minute, but it's your declaration that you were unwilling. If we know, the word should be know, if we know there was compulsion, it is not a gift. That's the rule. If it's compelled, it's not a gift. Now, here, she is very clearly facing pressure because they are withholding the investigation until she actually signs this, aside from the $50,000. But they're telling her, we're not investigating this guy unless you sign this non-disclosure agreement. What if, instead of saying we're withholding the investigation, they don't withhold the investigation, but let's say there is some kind of a threat to her. If you don't sign the NDA, we're gonna, some kind of an implication of, hey, maybe this was willing, maybe this was consensual, maybe there was a relationship. That kind of a threat to her. Would that constitute duress to disqualify the NDA? A threat to discredit her. Miriam thinks so. I get the nodding yes.
Even more so than the $50,000, because, you know, $50,000, take it or leave it, but to make threats to her that would affect her safety or her state of mind, I that sounds like even more duress than offering someone a ride.
So take a look at source number 17, and we find out that there's a little bit of a conflict. This is brought in the Shulchan Aruch in the Code of Jewish Law. Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote, whether one compels another person by striking him or hanging him up until he sells, they're dealing with a sale case, obviously, or he threatens him with something he could do, those all count as duress. Striking somebody, threatening him, those are duress, like Miriam suggests. Rabbi Moshe Isserles says, not so fast. He says, yes, for compelling somebody physically or destroys his property, yeah, then I agree with you. However, some disagree and believe that threats are nothing. For bandits, threaten emptily. Threats are empty. You don't know that they were going to carry it out. Maybe that doesn't qualify as obvious duress. It's a very interesting argument, which if we had more time, I would unpack more and go back into his sources. But even if it's not considered obviously unwilling, you still have the option called a moda'ah, where you inform witnesses in advance that you're only cooperating because you have to and you really don't want to. And this comes from source number 18. Source number 18 is the classic passage in the Talmud. Rav Huna said, if somebody hangs somebody up, right? Picture holding them up by the wall, right? That's what we're talking about, physical. And he sells. He says to him, you're going to sell me your car. And the guy sells him the car. The sale is valid, even though there was coercion. There's physical coercion. Why is it valid? Because anytime somebody sells, he wouldn't sell unless he were forced. And yet his sale is valid. He says, look, the assumption Talmudically is you don't sell your stuff. I'm not talking about you're in business. You don't sell your private property unless you don't have a choice. There is something that is pushing you to get rid of your private property. Now, we could talk about whether that applies in all circumstances, but the key point here is that in the event that you receive a benefit, the argument goes, maybe that was the reason why you did it. And therefore, you can't really argue duress, which then means you need, if you're in a situation where you're receiving some kind of compensation, let's say you're Susan in our case and you're receiving $50,000, you need a way to let everybody know, yeah, but I'm not doing this willingly. I don't want to do this. How? How do you do that? That's the moda'a document, in which you write up a document which says explicitly, I am doing this against my will. And as I brought for you in source number 19, but because we're short on time, I'm not going to read it out loud, but I brought it for you in source number 19 from the modern work Pisrei Choshen, there are certain rules that have to be satisfied in order to be able to do this moda'a. It has to be done in advance of the agreement. The witnesses have to know how you are being compelled. And at that point, it becomes valid, and it's valid even if you then say verbally, I am signing this thing willingly, because we know you're not signing this willingly. That's the way it works.
Does the other party have to see that, or just you and your witness?
The other party does not need to see it. So, in answer to our question, the NDA is not going to be valid. it will not be binding on Susan because we believe she was coerced. She may need to do a moda'a because she, you know, looks to the world like she's receiving payment for this. She's getting something for it. But here I want to note something else. I don't know that she's allowed to accept the $50,000. Right? Think about it. They're giving her, they're calling it a bonus, but it's clearly a condition for signing this, this NDA. If she's going to say, yes, I'm signing it, but then she's not going to follow it, she's going to break it, I don't think she can accept the $50,000. A little bit unclear because they called it a bonus, but something to think about. Clear? We're good so far?
Not really, to be honest, Robin.
Go ahead, Nathan. Correct, and it doesn't. Meaning, you're signing it because you were forced to sign it, because you wanted what, you know, should happen, which is the investigation. I don't think she can take the 50. I think the $50,000 are not hers. However, if somebody is being compelled, yes, I know, I saw the, someone messaged me saying, but in the case it says a bonus for hard work. The company is not calling it a, company is not linking it to the NDA. And I hear that. Maybe they've made themselves vulnerable in that regard. But I think that you have to answer Nathan's point, I think that you have to have the option of dealing with a situation where there's a power imbalance, you have a need, and someone is coercing you to do what they want in order to get what you need. We are only going to pursue this fellow who sent you these messages and harassed you in the event that you sign our agreement saying you're never going to talk to anybody. The request is inappropriate. So they have the ability to undo it. That's the idea.
But would Jewish law trump secular law in a real world case where...
So this is where we... So this is where we're going now, which is case number 4. Mandatory disclosure. So Susan signs the NDA. 3 weeks later, Anthony, her harasser, leaves the company. Susan is told he left rather than face the results of the investigation, right? He figures, let me get out. 2 months after that, Susan learns that Anthony has found a managerial position at another company, where he supervises a friend of hers. Under Jewish law, would Susan be allowed to tell her friend anything about her experiences with Anthony? Let's pretend that the NDA is actually binding. Okay? For, you know, however it was done, there was no modah, she received a gift, the NDA was binding. Is she really now not allowed to say anything? Because she signed the NDA. So under the Ontario system, and I brought it for you in source number 20, the Charter of Professional Accountants of Ontario Act, the general principle is that accountants, this is not the same case, this is not the same phenomenon. Nonetheless, applying it for accountants, the rule is that you are expected to keep information of your client secret, except there are certain exceptions, including exception E, which you see in number 60, if there are reasonable grounds for believing that there is a significant risk of harm to any person if the disclosure is not made, and that making the disclosure is likely to reduce the risk. If you know somebody else could get hurt, and they're very vague about that, risk of harm is a very vague term. By contrast, if you were to look in the Law Society of Ontario's code, they're very specific about what counts as harm. The accountants are much more vague than the lawyers, which I guess isn't so surprising. But the rule is there is an exception for harm. Now, I'm not sure how that will apply in the case of an NDA, and I didn't have a chance to research whether that will hold up in the case of an NDA. But in Jewish law, it is very clear. I have a duty to inform a person where there is a threat to them. It's called Velo Sa'amot al Dam Reyecha. Do not stand by while somebody's blood is being shed. I brought you the passage from the Talmud in source number 21 about the duty to intervene if you see somebody's drowning in a river, dragged by a beast, beset by bandits. There's some debate about whether that applies to financial harm, but it definitely applies in, if we're talking about physical harm. So the, so there definitely is within Jewish law a duty to tell. And this comes up all the time. Moshe asked me a question earlier. What if somebody just is silent? But silence, aside from being potentially false if asked a direct question, it's also a violation of do not stand by. If you take a look at source number 23, I'm jumping source number 22, but if you were to take a look at source number 23, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg says he's dealing with a case in which you know somebody who is epileptic and they just got their driver's license renewed and they didn't disclose that information. So you have a duty to step forward and inform the authorities that there is a reason why this person should not be driving. You have to be able to protect people. And based on that, there is a duty to disclose. You have to be careful how you do it. I brought in source number 24 limitations on this from Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, the Chafetz Chaim. His limitations include that you can only report personal experience or a verified account. You can't jump to conclusions about what happened and what laws were broken. You have to see if there's another way to avoid harm besides public disclosure. Don't magnify things. Make sure it's not a personal agenda. Like, there are restrictions on how you do this. But ultimately, there is a duty to speak up. So the last question you have to ask is, what if you ended up with a case in which the accounting code or the legal code would say don't tell, and Judaism requires that you tell? And I've dealt with various versions of this. We only have a minute, so I'm not going to be able to go on at length. But the answer largely depends on weighing potential harm to you in the event that you break the law, potential harm to the victim if you fail to disclose it, and potential harm to society in the event that confidentiality is not honored. Meaning, if let's say you have a lawyer who breaks confidentiality in order to protect their neighbor or somebody they know, and the result now is that clients don't trust lawyers and you've harmed the whole system of representation, you could have done greater harm by disclosing. So this is a bigger issue than we're dealing with right now. This is not something we're going to be able to deal with in full. Maybe when I send out the follow-up email, I'll send a link to a class I gave on confidentiality where I discussed this at length, because there's no time for it now. But in sum, we've recognized that Judaism will absolutely recognize the right of a company to limit access to their intellectual property via an NDA. That's for sure. Financial inducements, if done in a harassing way, are unethical, although valid. In the event that somebody is pushed to do this, and they're pushed in a way that's obvious, that's called duress and it won't be valid. If it's not so obvious, because there's also a benefit involved, or the threats to them are vague, then there really should be a moda'ah, a document saying, you know, or stating to witnesses, I am not doing this willingly. And finally, there will be a duty for Susan to tell her neighbor if her neighbor is going to become, is going to gain this fellow Anthony as her supervisor. Much more to say. Thank you very, very much. Next week, our topic is The Gifted Auditor, The Ethics of Swag. Thank you very much, everyone. And again, if you didn't sign in,